This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We are here to discuss the important news of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
We're going to start with a story from last Friday, actually, an announcement out of Germany that speaks to the future of Syria. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Germany meeting alongside his counterpart Heiko Maas there, the foreign minister of Germany, and they had a joint press conference where they talked about the future of Syria and what the United States involvement would look like in Syria, and then also what the German involvement would look like. Now, everything he said must be prefaced with the fact that he doesn't make the final decision on troop movements for the country. For Germany, it has to go through the German parliament and be ratified in the future. But he did say that Germany would be willing to support the United States' new planned safe zone in northeastern Syria. These safe zones are meant to ensure, I think we talked about a bit about them in the past, are meant to ensure the survival of the Kurds, basically. After the fight against the Islamic State in Syria, the Kurds were these people that fought alongside the United States against the Islamic State, but they're also the enemies of Turkey, and Turkey's extremely worried that since the Kurds are now strong, that inside Syria, that the Kurds adjacent Syria, those in Turkey, would then rise up and fight against the Turkish regime. And so they want to, the Turks want to keep the Kurds down, and the United States doesn't want to abandon its ally completely with the Kurds, so they want to create a safe zone in these Kurdish territories in northeastern Syria. Germany has said now that it would like to support that mission. They hinted, the foreign minister hinted, that they would like to support that with more support than they're giving right now. Right now, they helped the mission with reconnaissance flights and also refueling of jets in the air. But it looks like they want to have not necessarily troops on the ground just yet, but have active participation with their Tornado fighter jets. This was reported a day earlier in Spiegel and another couple of German magazines and newspapers, that the U.S. and Germany had been in talks going back to February to try and get Germany more involved. You remember that the United States wants to leave Syria. It doesn't want to be there, but it can't give up on the Kurds since it's fought alongside them for so long, and if they go, Turkey could end up fighting against the Kurds. Germany has said that they would be willing, at least in part, to pick up some of the slack.
So Brent, if you could just zoom back a little bit, and we talk quite a lot about Syria. The main actors that we've been focusing on, aside from the Syrian government, is Iran and Russia playing a role in that nation and in determining Syria's future. Just if you could put that in context and why it's significant now that Germany is saying we want a stake in its future as well.
Okay, so there are so many players, which is why it gets very difficult in Syria. But yes, you have the Syrian regime that is supported right now by Russia and Iran. We have talked about how Iran's star is falling inside Syria right now in support of the Syrian regime because they're trying to use Syria as a forward operating base to fight against Israel. The Russians don't like that. We talk about that mainly and how Iran looks to be losing hold. Well, the other side of that is not just that Russia is going to have control of the Assad regime or the future Syrian regime, but we know the Bible prophecy talks about Germany getting involved in Syria. And so we've been very much looking for an entrance of a European force or specifically a German force into Syria. And so it looks like where this force will participate mostly isn't fighting against the Assad regime. It's not fighting against the Russians. It's in this zone that the Russians and even the Iranians right now probably aren't too concerned about, northwestern or northeastern Syria. The Russians and even the Iranians are mainly concerned about Western Syria and controlling that territory. We're talking about Eastern Syria, where the U.S. forces are. What's interesting about this this involvement is that as Germany, obviously they would have a stake in wanting to preserve some type of truce or some type of safe zone, because they are worried about the influx of further refugees. If there were safe zones in northern Syria back in 2014 and 15, that's where the millions of refugees that were headed across the border into Turkey and then onto Europe mm-hmm. would have gone. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have been concentration camps. Some people would have called them that. But they would have been camps for refugees until the events died down and they could go back to their homes. Germany should have done it back then. The United States probably could have done something like that back then, and it would have saved Germany and Europe a whole host of problems and troubles. Now they are looking to create such an area, and Germany sees that it's responsibility at least to support what the United States is doing. Now let's even today, there was the United States, one of the Syrian envoys, that came out and said, Europe doesn't look like they're going to help too much. No, it'll probably be more American. And so this is highly contentious, to have German forces in an active military role in the Middle East, not just training people, but actually bombing people if the need comes. And so you will see contrary reports about this. But Germany definitely has a stake in it, and Bible prophecy says that their presence is going to increase. And it'll increase again in eastern Syria, this very important region of eastern Syria, which is the dividing line in terms of Bible prophecy between two rival alliances, the King of the South, Radical Islam, led by Iran, which will include Iraq. And then Syria, we know, is going to go to the Psalm 83 alliance, which is actually allied with a German-led Europe. And so we expect Germany to come in there, right in this territory of eastern Syria, and maintain control. And we know that eventually, from that location, that would be the perfect vantage point to actually have a defensive line or even an offensive line against a belligerent Iran in the future.
Okay, so the ultimately, because we're expecting this secession between Syria and Iran, the significance of a German presence in Syria, as you said, it's this is just a statement of intent. It's not nothing on the ground at this point, but we would expect that this would be the wedge that would enable Germany to get its presence in there. What does that mean for Iran?
Well, I think Iran right now, Germany has been their best friend. And so I don't think they see Germany as an adversary right now. And this prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, sorry, in verse 40, talks about the King of the North, which is German-led Europe, having this policy of the way that attacks Iran is like a whirlwind. It encircles Iran, encircles Iranian assets, and this would be one of the perfect fronts to do that, a perfect baseline to do that, is from eastern Syria. It also speaks to the swiftness that Iran gets attacked by Germany after it pushes at Germany and Europe. And so maybe it's a case where Iran doesn't see Germany being a threat whatsoever. They would probably welcome Germany in right now instead of the United States in eastern Syria. They'd probably love it, because they see the United States as the main belligerent force against them, their main adversary. And so they would probably welcome it. But in the end, the United States is not the one, the Bible prophecy says, the United States isn't the one that destroys, isn't the nation that destroys Iran and radical Islam. It's Germany. And so that's why we expect Germany to get close to the Iranian regime, and eastern Syria is the perfect spot to do it.
All right, we appreciate that. If you want more information about this, we do have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now called Germany Prepared to Participate Militarily in Syria. Go check that out. It's on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Brent. Russia publicized an eye-popping video of a powerful new weapon it has just successfully tested. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this video was published on June 4th by the Russian Ministry of Defense, and it shows the successful launch of a new hypersonic interceptor missile. It's a very short clip. It's just about 35 seconds long, but it's hard to convey just how stunning the speed of this missile's launch off the ground is. I watched this clip over and over again just because it was unlike any missile launch I'd ever seen, and I just couldn't believe the sheer power on display there. And we'll have that video embedded in our website article about this, which will go up on thetrumpet.com soon. So anyone who would like to can take a look at it there. But this launch was actually in Kazakhstan. It was at a testing range that Russia uses there in the southeastern part of the country. Apparently, Russia doesn't have enough space for its own testing ranges. And Russia said that the missile did successfully hit its target. And they haven't stated yet, publicly anyway, exactly what missile this was. But it's believed to have been the PRS-1M hypersonic interceptor missile. The Russian news outlet Gazeta.ru analyzed the launch footage, and they said that the missile screamed into the atmosphere at 2.48 miles per second. So that's that's several times faster than the speed of a bullet, which is 2,500 miles per second on average, and it comes to more than 8,900 miles per hour. So that's more than 10 times the speed of sound. So it's a Mach 10 missile, and that makes it one of the fastest missiles in the world. And then they're also maneuverable. So their trajectory can be rapidly changed mid-flight. So the combination of this stunning speed and this maneuverability makes these very formidable and nearly impossible for others to stop them. And Russia 24 is a state-owned Russian news channel, and they said that no other country has a weapon like this. So it's a really remarkable development for the Russian military.
So you talked about some of the capabilities of this missile, and we have discussed introduction of this hypersonic missile technology. Tell us what they are intending these weapons to be used for, the kind of capability it gives to a nation that has this technology.
Sure, yeah. Well, this is it's an interceptor missile, so they say this would be used, you know, predominantly in a defensive fashion to strike down potential incoming missiles, especially ballistic missiles from anyone who might be firing on Russia. And the PRS-1M is also able to carry a nuclear warhead of several kilotons. So that greatly increases its ability to kill those incoming warheads. But also, if this were to be fired on a target on the ground, though, I think it would make the weapons that were dropped on Japan look like firecrackers, really, and just do unbelievable amounts of damage. But they're able to hit targets at a range of 220 miles and at an altitude of about 31 miles. So it's a very advanced piece of weaponry.
So what's the difference between an interceptor missile and just a regular missile that, like you said, if this were launched and it were hitting a target on the ground, it would obviously be, if it's able to carry a nuclear payload, that would be just as damaging as something that didn't have the word interceptor on it. I'm unclear as to the distinction.
Well, Richard may be able to actually clarify this, but from what I understand, an interceptor missile requires far greater precision. It's a lot easier to just launch something offensively at a target on the ground. The ground is stationary. Mm-hmm. Than it would be to strike an incoming missile that might be moving at thousands of miles per hour. So it requires an incredibly sophisticated maneuverability in most cases. And then also, I think that Russia likes to talk about interceptor missiles because it can sort of hide behind the guise that this is defensive weaponry. Mm-hmm. These are strictly for defensive purposes. If NATO attacks us, we have this. But I, from what I understand, they can all be used offensively just as well.
So we have to view this in context of a lot of the efforts that Russia has been making to upgrade its military. We've talked about the scale of nuclear weapons that it has developed with the Satan II missile. That was, what, about a year ago, and its general militarization. Maybe you could just put it in context with what else Russia is doing on this front.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, there have been, you know, amazing moves toward just revamping Russia's military power, modernizing particularly its nuclear forces, but really all branches of its military and all aspects of its weaponry. And that's because Russian President Vladimir Putin, since the beginning of his reign back in 2000, his goal has really been to make the world respect Russia once again, to fear Russia once again. He wants the world to see them the way they did during the Soviet era, as a as an empire to be feared. Early in his reign, Putin called the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest collapse, or the greatest catastrophe, rather, of the 20th century. And he's been working to try to rebuild that empire. So when he invaded Georgia and took some of their territory and put it under Russia's control, that was a part of that strategy. Same thing with Crimea, when he took that peninsula from Ukraine and asserted Russian control over it, that was a part of the strategy. And all of this focus on developing weaponry, nuclear warheads, this new PRS-1M hypersonic interceptor missile, it's all part of that same overall strategy, just working to boost Russian power, to be able to challenge the U.S. and NATO, and just kind of make the world see Russia as a power to really be feared. And a lot of the rhetoric that we hear about Russia, you know, when we talk about these kind of developments, is about the Russians being able to challenge the United States. But really, the more important region to watch for a response to these kinds of Russian developments is Europe. Back in 2014, shortly after Russia had taken the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury spoke about the effect that all of this Russian aggression we're seeing is having on Europe, and he put it in the context of Bible prophecy. At that time, he wrote, quote, "We've been prophesying for around 70 years that Eastern Europe would become a vital part of a new European superpower, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This prophecy is directly related to the Crimean crisis. The fear you see in Europe, because of events in Crimea, is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way, and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." So just, I think he does an amazing job there, just putting this into perspective, showing how, as much as the Americans may fear this, ultimately, if we are viewing it through the lens of prophecy, we need to be focused on the European reaction to it.
Right, and even geography.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, Ukraine is part of Europe, so it's happening right there. And the Europeans have not forgotten what happened in Georgia in 2008. They've not forgotten Crimea in 2014. And they see this unfathomably destructive weaponry, these tests that we just saw this week. And all of this fear is prompting the Europeans to seek closer unification with each other so they can kind of stand up to what they see, that looming Russian shadow just growing darker.
Well, we should put a link to that article by Gerald Fleury in the show notes. What's that article?
It's called "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe."
All right, very good. We will do that. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Another resignation in Germany's government could hasten the already inevitable end of Chancellor Angela Merkel's term in office. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so last week we talked about the European elections and the big effect this had on German politics. And, well, that continued to reverberate this week. So the Social Democratic Party, Angela Merkel's left-wing coalition partners, their leader resigned after thinking about the results of this leadership election. And she'd led her party to the worst defeat ever. And so she stepped down. So this kind of puts everything all up in the air now for the coalition. I think what's interesting is not only did she step down, but just about everybody else who would be considered a front runner for this job has said, no, I don't want it. They're having a hard time even working out how to do the leadership elections because nobody wants to lead the party. In fact, they don't even have an interim leader. They have a board of three interim leaders that is going to be steering the party in the month or two ahead that it takes them to find a new leader. Now, this obviously affects more than just this main left-wing coalition party. It also affects the coalition as a whole. So if you remember, they had the longest coalition negotiations by far in Germany's history to put this together. They finally got it together. Well, now that they've got these leadership elections, the SDP has said, well, we're going to stick with the coalition until June 24th. And then at that point, They're going to discuss it. They're going to have a revision clause. They'll probably put forward new demands to Angela Merkel, saying, well, if we're going to stay with your coalition, we want this and this and this and this. So really, you've got something that's a symptom of the mess in German politics and something that's just going to keep putting the pressure up on German politics. Bloomberg Opinion started their piece on the subject saying that Sunday marked another important stage in the implosion of Germany's two-party system. We're just seeing Germany's political system to continue to not function. Germany has been the model of stability. I can't remember exactly the statistics, but they've had a handful of chancellors since the end of World War II, while a whole host of other European countries almost get through a different leader every other year or so. Italy, I'm looking at you especially. So it's this kind of turmoil. I mean, they've still got Angela Merkel in office, but political turmoil in general is really unusual here. And at the same time, they've typically had this two-party system. And you look at, you go back to the 90s and before, and the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats would be on roughly 40-50% of the vote each, you know, depending on who was winning that particular election. Now, both parties are lucky if they get 50% between the two of them, mm-hmm. and they haven't even managed that in recent elections. So you're seeing that both the parties that govern Germany pretty much since World War II, both becoming incredibly unpopular. And so now you're looking at this new politics. We saw some of that this week where you're potentially getting a coalition between the Greens, the Social Democrats, and the far left Linke, or left party, ruling the German state of Bremen. So this would be seeing the left party there, basically the communists that ruled East Germany for the Soviet Union. You know, they're the successor to that communist party. You're looking at things kind of getting so out of whack that they would be coming into the government of a West German state. That's the kind of chaos and confusion we're seeing right now.
So, Richard, we talk quite a lot about the prophecies of a strong German leader coming in to resolve these kinds of this political chaos that we see in Germany. What is your view of, I don't know if you can talk about in general how this may lead to someone coming in the way that we're expecting according to prophecy, or maybe even specifically about where Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg is as all of this is unfolding. Is he is anyone saying, you know, when are you going to get into this and solve this, or what's happening with him?
Yeah, I mean it's hard to say anything I think too specific on that question. Like we talked about last week, the Bible says this leader is going to come in by flatteries. He's not going to be given the honor of the kingdom. You look at what it says in Daniel about him coming to power, and it's in some kind of unorthodox manner. And so when you see politics gumming up, when you see ineffectual coalition after ineffectual coalition, when you see just people unable to get anyone, any kind of strong leadership through the regular channels, and then when you look outside Germany and you see the angle that Jeremiah talked about with Europe growing fearful of Russia, and you see this, especially after Russia does something, you get an uptick in that sentiment each time, but you see this desire for, okay, well, we need a strong man, maybe need someone a bit more like Vladimir Putin who can stand up for our interests, who can protect us from the Middle East, then you can see people being more willing to depart from the regular ways of getting people into government. Mm-hmm. I think beyond that, you could probably come up with half a dozen different potential ways that you could have someone come in this unorthodox way, and it probably wouldn't end up being even one of those ways, I guess. Mm-hmm. But as Mr. Flurry said in the January cover issue of the Trumpet print, just the circumstances that you're seeing in Germany with the way traditional politics just doesn't seem to be working, it sets the stage perfectly for that prophecy to be fulfilled.
Well, we do have an article up on the front page of thetrumpet.com from this week, German coalition government rattled by another resignation. You can find that there, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes for today's program as well. Thank you for that, Richard. America's president is exploring every possible means of halting illegal immigration across the southern border, including most recently the threat of economic punishment against Mexico. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the illegal immigration has been rising, as we've covered on this program many times before. I believe there has been over a million apprehensions this year, and that's just the ones that have been caught. And so it's escalated to the point where American officials met with Mexican officials Wednesday to try to hammer out some sort of deal where the Mexicans stop these immigrants from coming across the border. Most of them are not actually Mexicans. They're Guatemalans and other Central Americans, and the Mexicans don't want to stop them from coming in the United States because then they'd be in their country.
Right.
And so to try to use a little bit of carrot and stick diplomacy, President Trump's threatened this Wednesday to put a 5% tariff on all Mexican imports into the United States if Mexico doesn't agree to stop these immigrant flows. That would be a tax every time a American company wants to buy anything from Mexico. They'd have to pay the government, the U.S. government, a 5% tax. That's extra money for the U.S. government, and kind of a incentive to have American companies not buy goods from Mexico, because you don't want to pay the tax. If you don't want to pay the tax, you don't buy the goods. If you don't buy the goods, the Mexicans don't get American money for their goods. If the Mexicans don't get American money for their goods, they've either got to find someone else to sell this stuff to, or just back down and stop the immigrants from coming, so this will all go away. But quite serious. They met again yesterday, still didn't come up with a deal. President Trump's not backing down. He said that if he goes through with it, he said the 5% tariffs he wants to put in place this Monday. And if those don't work, he'll gradually increase them to where they could be as high as 25% tariffs by October. But the Mexican government doesn't seem to be backing down either. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador allegedly has a list of American goods that he wants to pose retaliatory tariffs on. That's why he said that instead of stopping the immigrants from coming, he said it was like, well, if you put tariffs on me, I'll put tariffs on you until you take your tariffs away. No specific word on what those tariffs will, what the percentage of those tariffs will be. I think most officials said that Mexico won't risk putting a tariff on U.S. corn imports. They need American corn very badly. But they're looking at putting a tax on other U.S. agricultural goods, especially milk. When you look at the trade statistics, this is really very important to American food security. A lot of people just take it for granted that you go to the grocery store and there's food there. But most of our cucumbers, our watermelons, green onions, blackberries, pineapples, papayas, and avocados come from Mexico. We're very reliant on Mexico for those foods. And also, we sell $20 billion, almost $20 billion in agricultural goods to Mexico. So in addition to American consumers being reliant on all those foods I just rattled off for their kitchen tables, you've got American farmers who are reliant on Mexico for $20 billion in income because they're selling them corn and rice and milk and eggs and chickens and pecans and beef and other goods. They're actually our biggest trade partner agriculturally, and that seems what this dispute over immigration is going to fight play out over, with rising tariffs on agricultural goods to where America can no longer afford to buy cucumbers and watermelons and avocados from Mexico, and American farmers lose that income they're getting from selling corn and milk and other things to Mexico.
You were talking on Wednesday about the pressures on American farmers, including the weather disasters and the trade policies. Here's another storm cloud looming on the horizon, if you want to put it that way, that could be putting additional pressure on America's food supply.
Right, because American farmers are already spend the vast majority of their soybean crops to China. That's changed already. There's a similar tariff dispute between the U.S. and China involving soybeans. And so the Chinese have already almost stopped buying American soybeans completely and are buying from Brazil instead. Mexico was considering doing the same thing. Soybeans are not as big an issue between the U.S. and Mexico. It's mostly dairy products that's the sticking point. They're our biggest export market for milk. But the European farmers, a lot of farmers in Germany and Austria who have a lot of milk to sell. And so they're hoping, Mexico's hoping for a trade deal with the European Union so they can buy German milk similar to how the Brazilians are selling soybeans to China, and you cut America out of both markets. And that's kind of what I'm talking about Wednesday, is there's this two-fisted punch talked about in the Bible. There's these prophecies in Ezekiel 4 and Ezekiel 5 about trade siege, where God even has Ezekiel do a strange thing and like lay on his side for 390 days. And then the rest of the chapter contains details about how bad things are going to be in the siege, how extensive the food rationing is going to be, because it's hard to get food into a city when it's under siege. Similarly, applying it in end time, it's hard to get food into a nation when it's under siege. So this prophecy is about a trade war, really, specifically a trade war involving agricultural products, the food supplies that Americans are relying on their grocery stores, where other nations, like a mart of nations, teams up against the United States and stops selling them food. I think the statistics show that America produces 80% of the food it eats, and that number is coming down as weather disasters are putting our farmers under pressure. But still, that's 20% and growing food we get from places like Mexico. And so you get these trade wars where Mexico's looking for other trade partners for their agricultural trade. Too many nations start jumping on Mexico's China's sides looking for other agricultural markets, and you have a situation like is described in Ezekiel, where just the nation's under siege, no food comes in and out, and there's not enough domestic production to meet domestic demand.
Well, it's clearly going to be a whole lot of factors contributing to that. And in some ways, you think of President Trump trying to find some way to prevent a million immigrants from coming over every few months, and it's hard to fault him for pursuing these kinds of policies in order to try to do that. It may have those kinds of effects as part of a number of factors that would contribute to those famine-like conditions and the siege against the United States. At the same time, you think, well, would he even be having to pursue this if he had a Congress that was supportive of the idea of protecting our own borders and trying to keep this flood of immigrants out of the country and just uphold the laws of the land? But nevertheless, those prophecies definitely are there, and they are real, and they are coming, and the warning is there for us to heed. So we do appreciate that. And if you have any thoughts on what people should go to find out more information about this as far as the prophetic angle goes, where would you send them?
Right. The Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has a couple different chapters, one entitled Terrorism and Race Riot, the another entitled Superpower Under Siege, that goes in detail through Ezekiel 4 and Ezekiel 5 and gives all the prophetic symbolism of why Ezekiel's on his stride for 390 days and the food rationing in ancient Jerusalem and how that applies to modern-day nations.
Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, more evidence of Iran's pushy foreign policy, what the Pope is praying for, and a stunning policy by the Canadian government to encourage more abortion worldwide. We'll have that and more right after this short break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A month ago, some oil tankers were attacked in the waters near Iran, and an investigation into the attacks is pointing to a familiar aggressor. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So we've discussed this at the time. These were four tankers. A couple of them were belonged to the Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and then there was a Norse tanker as well that were attacked. And it was really interesting. We talked about it previously, how these attacks took place at the edge of a port where the UAE can bypass basically the Strait of Hormuz to get oil to the Indian Ocean without having to go through there, load the tankers of oil and let them leave. Anyhow, over the past, let's say, 20 days, there has been no real evidence put forward that it was Iran that was behind these attacks. And there still isn't 100% clarity on it. Although there was just this week presented to the United Nations Security Council a preliminary investigation by the North, Saudis, and the UAE that said it was most likely a state actor that did do this attack. Now, some of the details from this attack are quite interesting. What it showed was it was a highly sophisticated attack. There's about 100 of these vessels, tankers, that are at anchor off this port. And so four of them were specifically chosen. They weren't next to each other, and the bombs themselves were detonated within an hour of each other. They were limpet mines, which are magnetic timed mines that were placed underneath the waterline at the back of each of these ships in the same location. And they were placed at a very important location. This is what it says in the report. The explosive charges were placed with a high degree of precision under the waterline in ways that were designed to incapacitate the ships without sinking them or detonating their cargoes, indicating minute knowledge of the design of the targeted ships. And so they knew exactly what they were doing. Divers had to do this. They said that these boats were approached by fast attack boats. Iran has a fleet of those, and divers were offloaded, mines were set, and then they retreated back, and then a few hours later, these mines went off. And so while they didn't say it was Iran, the United States came out last week and said it most definitely was Iran. It was the IRGC, because the United States showed proof that on May 12th, you did have 20 attack boats come from Iran towards the United Arab Emirates. And so I guess the point that I would like to bring out isn't that it was Iran. I think everybody knows it was Iran. The Saudis are probably going to be trying to just show that they're not super biased and just say it's a state actor. But the teams that have the countries that have these type of abilities, Iran is at the foremost of that list. But it does show how, let's say, not just sophisticated, but also precise Iran was on its choice of targets and how it attacked. It chose not to damage the vessels to the degree that the oil would spill out. It chose to only incapacitate them. This was a warning shot by Iran against the rest of the oil-carrying world. We can target your ships. We know how to do it, and we can do it again if we so choose.
So that message, just elaborate that on that a little bit, that Iran is basically trying to say what to the world?
Well, at this point, I mean, well, if we go back to the events of May, there is a series of events that shows that Iran was considering doing probably something a bit more dangerous in the region, attacking U.S. forces. The U.S. also has reported on the fact that it was tracking Iranian commercial ships that had missiles loaded onto them, including their launchers. And that's what prompted Bolton's speech. That's what prompted the carrier group to go. Iran was preparing for something. And it looks like the American presence Iran has decided to not go ahead in whatever they were planning to do. But it does still show that Iran does want the world to know that if their oil cannot be sold, that they have two choices: negotiations with the United States, which does put them back into a difficult situation, or they decide to lash out at the world. Now, I've listened and watched and read every type of commentator on Iran over the past couple of weeks, and nobody thinks that they are going to act. Everybody thinks that they are going back to negotiations with the United States, that they cannot last the financial sanctions because they're only selling 300 or 200,000 barrels per oil per day, 800,000 less than they need to actually survive. But Iran has its warning out there. It does have a warning to show that, no, we can't defeat you in war, but we can incapacitate the world's oil market for a time. That can be dangerous for you, the United States, and also for Europe.
Well, we will continue to watch. Iran can be a bit unpredictable. And as you said, this does show just how sophisticated their military capability can be. This is like special forces type of an operation here, and very targeted and very precise. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out as the United States continues to ramp up economic pressure against Iran, the way that Europe responds to that, the way that other customers of Iranian oil respond. So we will keep our eyes on that. We appreciate that very much, Brent. The Pope was asked his thoughts about the unusual election results that are coming in from countries around Europe, and he gave a very interesting and prophetically significant answer. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, the Pope gave one of his famous kind of off-the-cuff, on-an-aeroplane interviews, and it is interesting to get his thoughts on Europe. So, as you said, he was asked about the European election results, and he responded fairly prudently, rather than getting into specific election or specific politicians. He gave his thoughts on Europe as a whole. So he urged believers to pray for European unity. He told non-believers to hope from the bottom of your heart. He basically talked about some of the challenges facing Europe. He said someone could ask under their breath, is this perhaps the end of a 70-year adventure? Really painting in quite dramatic terms the fact that we could be looking at the end of the European Union, and about the being very honest about the challenges that Europe faces. And he said that Europe had to rediscover or to take up again the mysticism of its founding fathers. So an allusion to going back to the beliefs of those that founded Europe.
So here you have a Pope who is, quite a bit further left than say like his predecessor and what we've seen before him in the Vatican, who is still saying that European unity is very important, and even that one would presume that the Catholic Church needs to play an important role in that.
Yeah, I think it's just interesting just to see he's asked off the cuff about Europe, and it's immediately in to pray for Europe. We need Europe. It's just so reflexive with him and with a whole lot, really with the Catholic Church as a whole. And it's just an important reminder of how foundational the Catholic Church was to the European Union. So many of these men that were kind of the founding fathers of the European Union, men like Jean Monnet, Robert Schuman, Di Gasperi, Otto von Habsburg, Konrad Adenauer, they saw their pursuit of Europe, yes, political terms, but also they saw it in religious terms, even to the point that the Catholic Church has canonized Schumann and Di Gasperi, these kind of founding fathers, maybe not as well known as Monet, but the Catholic Church has canonized them because they saw their pursuit of this European Union in those religious terms.
That's the mysticism that the Pope is talking about, the mysticism
exactly.
of the founding fathers.
Yeah, that's what he's reminding us of. In Topic magazine in 1962, they wrote, "The Vatican, usually cautious over political changes, not of its own inspiration, now considers the common market the work of divine providence. Not since the time of Spain's Charles V has a Roman Catholic political force been so strongly wielded. Not since the end of the Holy Roman Empire has the Holy See been offered a Catholic rallying point like the common market. If the Pact of Rome, which created the common market, had been signed within the Vatican's walls, it could not have favored the church more." And that's from a secular news magazine. that was a prominent magazine at the time. So it's a reminder of the way that the Catholic Church has always supported the European Union, and it's that is absolutely central to Bible prophecy. The Bible talks about this prophesied empire, this prophesied superpower to arise in Europe, and it really talks about the role the Catholic Church plays in leading and guiding this. You can see that in Revelation 17 that talks about a woman guiding this power, and the woman in Bible prophecy is a church. It's a power guided by the church, and you see the Catholic Church is being so foundational in guiding the European Union, and then just even this support now from the Pope today, this week, pray for the European Union. That's right in line with what the Bible says about this power.
Such a foundational prophecy. Where would you send listeners for more information about that, Richard?
Well, we have our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, and actually chapter 8 of that booklet, The Seventh and Final Resurrection Now Here, goes through a lot of that history and then of the Catholic Church's role in the founding of the European Union. And then that book as a whole gives you a lot of great detail and proof about what the Bible says about this coming European power.
Okay, thank you, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. America has been warning other nations to avoid doing business with a Chinese technology company, a giant company, because of concerns over cyber espionage and cyber attacks. One nation in particular is ignoring those warnings. To learn which one, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we spoke on the show last week about Chinese President Xi Jinping's plans to visit Vladimir Putin in Russia, and that meeting is now in the rearview mirror. It's come and gone, and it looks to have been quite a fruitful visit for these two. And one of the big developments during it was that they reached a deal for the Chinese company Huawei to build Russia's first 5G wireless network. So as you mentioned, Huawei has been in the news quite a lot lately because it's become really a focal point in the escalating trade war between the U.S. and China. The Trump administration in the U.S. has placed Huawei specifically in the crosshairs of that by placing it on the U.S. Commerce Department's entities list. By placing it on that list, it means that Huawei is not able to obtain many of the vital components such as microchips that it needs to make its cell phones and many of its other products without having specific permission from the American government, which is unlikely. As a result of that move, Google has already suspended Huawei's Android contract. The UK firm ARM suspended all business ties with Huawei. Intel and Qualcomm and many others have made similar moves. And the U.S. has specifically addressed Huawei's 5G networks as well. It banned those in the U.S. It cautioned America's allies against using them, saying that Beijing can use the, you know, the tentacles that it kind of extends through this network to spy on those countries. And so far, those moves do seem to be taking quite a lot of the wind out of the sails of Huawei in some ways. But now you have Russia saying, despite the threat of Beijing spying, sign us up. You know, they don't share in Washington's concerns about being spied on, possibly because they have back-channel assurances from Beijing that that won't happen for Russia. But either way, this comes at a great time for this embattled Chinese company. It's really a ray of sunshine that pierces the gloom that has really set in since the U.S. put Huawei in the crosshairs.
We've been talking quite a bit about the, as you mentioned last week, even about the signs of cooperation continuing to increase between Russia and China. This is just one more example of that.
That's right. Even just during this visit that happened this week between Xi and Putin, they upgraded their partnership to a new level once again. I'm not sure how many more levels could possibly exist here, but it's now a comprehensive strategic partnership of coordination in a new era. Wow. That's the official title.
Very impressive.
Yeah. And Putin said that relations between them are now at an unprecedentedly high level. And he added, that's no exaggeration. And I think he's exactly right about that. Economically, they're drawing closer and closer. Last year, they reached $108 billion of trade. Part of this mushrooming trade volume is just that the two are finding comfort in each other's arms as the U.S. targets both of them. With, mm-hmm. with Russia, those targets are sanctions. With China, it's this trade war. Politically, they're in lockstep. Even at this meeting, they discussed how they both see totally eye to eye on Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, the Arctic, and so many other issues. And then probably the most important facet of the diamond is in the military realm. That's, you know, Russia and China have now held more than 30 sets of military drills as they iron out all these details of how to coordinate military cooperation. Yesterday, I reached out to a senior research fellow at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. He's an analyst named Vasily Kashin, who specializes in Russia-China relations, and we're supposed to connect later today to discuss this Huawei deal. But last year, he wrote a report for the Center of Naval Analyses focusing just on Russia-China military cooperation. And one quote of it says, "If at some point Russia and China decide to jointly intervene in a local conflict, their militaries would act as a very strong force multiplier for each other." So Kashin believes that the groundwork is already laid for them to be able to support each other during a conflict. And that just speaks to a remarkably high level of very intimate military cooperation.
Mm-hmm. For more information, where would you send people?
Yes, to Russia and China in Prophecy. This really shows that this is a biblically prophesied union that we're seeing happening right now between Russia and China. Revelation 16 talks about the kings of the East being a major player in World War III, and Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about how those kings will be Russia as the head one, and China in a secondary position of leadership, and then with several others in there too. But Russia and China in Prophecy lays out all those all the Bible prophecies powerfully.
Excellent. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Well, does the world need more abortion? Canada's prime minister thinks yes. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is actually a really related story when you look into the prophecies concerning to it, to what we talked in the first half, that we talked specifically prophecies in Ezekiel 4 and Ezekiel 5 about trade war, famine, and pestilence in the nations of end time Israel, you know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Great Britain. But God's just not sending these curses randomly. He gives a reason in Ezekiel 5 as he's talking about the famine and the pestilence and the trade seeds. He says, "This is Jerusalem. I have set it in the midst of the nations and the countries that are around about her. And she has changed my judgments into wickedness more than the nations, and my statutes more than the countries that are around about her." So this is talking about these Israelite nations actually being more sinful than even the nations around them, which gets into what happened in Canada this week with the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He delivered a speech at the Women's Delivery 2019 conference, pledging $1.4 billion in Canadian taxpayer dollars to fund abortion in like third world countries around the world. So not only is Canada and the States, as far as we know, like leading the world in abortion, 60 million in the United States since Roe versus Wade, babies aborted. They're now raising money and even sending it to like third world African and Asian countries for women who are too poor to get an abortion to be able to do that as well. There's a article we can put in the show notes about is abortion murder that we've put forward on the show before that can definitely show you from the Bible why God regards abortion as such a horrendous sin, something that America and Canada and other Israelite nations are leading the world in, not only leading the world in that it's worse here than other places, but leading the world in that we're actually trying to get them to catch up to us.
That is terrible. We appreciate you sharing that with us. Andrew, I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com and find links to all the articles and literature that we discussed on the program today. Email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Robert Ingersoll. The true civilization is where every man gives to every other every right that he claims for himself. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.